This is the April 2014 edition of the Saturday Selection on Monocle 24. Hi, and welcome to the Saturday Selection, the best of the weekend edition on Monocle 24, with me, Georgina Godwin. Here's your chance to hear the best of our weekend output with a selection of my favourite interviews from the month that's been during the Saturday weekend edition. This month, we spoke to James Ward, the organiser of a surprisingly successful conference which focuses on the mundane, the ordinary, the obvious and the overlooked.
I mean, you sort of imagine Ladybird books to be kind of safe and twee, but there is sort of quite a strong modernist agenda behind the books.
We delved into power so soft it's almost fluffy when we celebrated 40 years of ABBA, including the books, the museum and the enormous success of Sweden's biggest musical export.
Standing in the wing, I see Frida do a dance routine that she does. She did a big spin and this wig just came off and it flew like a bird over the stage.
Plus, we met Dave Broom, who wrote a book about whiskey, more specifically a manual that teaches us how best to enjoy the drink, with recipes for breakfast in bed, to wonderful new whiskies coming out of Sweden and Iceland, and more traditional blends from further afield.
They're making it in a very unique way, so that they're taking cognizance of what grows around them, of their heritage, of their flavours, and actually making whiskey that speaks about where it is coming from.
So, a very diverse hour ahead here on the Saturday Selection with me, Georgina Godwin. First, the Boring Conference is a one-day celebration of all things boring. Created in response to the cancellation of the 2010 Interesting Conference, the speakers focus on subjects often considered trivial and pointless, but when examined more closely, reveal themselves to be deeply fascinating. I invited the conference founder and director, James Ward, onto the weekend edition to find out what makes the tedious fascinating enough to be worthy of an entire conference.
For some reason, there are certain activities or areas of our lives which it's kind of not considered acceptable to be interested in. So someone can be fanatical about football and they could name every single score in the FA Cup final going back like for decades, and that's kind of considered fine if you're sort of in the pub, like, oh, this guy knows his football. Or it's the same with sort of cars and things like that. Oh, you know, you can name whatever car it is and that's considered fine. Whereas if you dedicate that same amount of energy to, for instance, hand dryers, you're considered weird. But it's the exact same activity. You've done the same thing. You've filled your brain with information which is related to one particular thing. But for some reason, we've decided these things are acceptable and these things you're weird.
So when you ask people to speak at the conference, you just say something boring and don't give them a topic. They choose it. And do they choose something that they think is boring or that they think is interesting?
Well, I kind of let people interpret the words in different ways. I always say that the theme is boring, but the content shouldn't be. And so because people are able to interpret it in so many different ways, we have like a really wide, varied program, I guess, throughout the day. So, for instance, last year we had a guy called Ben Target, who's a comedian who is spectacular. And for his piece, he rollerbladed around the hall for 10 minutes whilst there was a recording of him reading from a book on sort of densities and weights of different types of metal. And I thought it was spellbounding and I was absolutely like adored it. Quite a few other people did not feel the same way, but there's no way that I could have come up with that. I would not have had an idea that someone should do that and then know who to ask. It was just because that was the thought that came into his head when he saw that word.
And if people came and didn't like it, you could always say, well, what do you expect? It's called a boring
exactly,
conference.
Exactly. I mean, the good thing about the name is that it sets expectations very, very low. The only possible problem is that someone might complain that it was too interesting, but I don't think I'll give them their money back. But I mean, it's kind of like, it's difficult to complain that you had an entertaining day.
Who's going to be there this year?
We've got John Grindrod, who's written a book called Concretopia, which is about post-war architecture. He's going to be talking about the hidden modernism in Ladybird books. We've got
There is a lot of that, presumably?
There is. You'd be surprised. I mean, you sort of imagine Lady Bird books to be kind of safe and twee, but there is sort of quite a strong modernist agenda behind the books. We've got Helen Saltzman from the Answer Me This podcast. She's going to be talking about sort of 1930s cookery books and the questionable attitude towards women displayed in them. We've got someone talking about eggs. We've got someone
from what perspective?
You'll have to come on the 31st and find out. We've got someone talking about Eric Clapton's Bookshelf. And again, that's one I'm not entirely sure what that's going to be, but I was absolutely just sold on the title. As soon as someone said, I'd like to talk about Eric Clapton's Bookshelf, I thought, yep, okay, you're on. We're going to hopefully, depending on the technology, we want to get two people playing a game of the 1980s Atari game Pong live on a big screen, and then have two people with keyboards playing a sort of live soundtrack. Again, that's not an idea that came into my head. That's something that someone approached me and said, would this be something that we could do? And I was, again, just like, yeah, that sounds good. Let's work out the details later.
I was very taken by the idea of one discussion that I believe will be taking place, which is the overly literal translations of German film titles.
Yes. I mean, they have... It's when, I guess, a film title is translated into German and then translated back into English. They have very strange sounding film titles. For instance, Airplane, I think it's called something in German, it was called something like The Extraordinary Adventures of a Crazy Airplane, and then Airplane 2 was called The Extraordinary Adventures of a Crazy Airplane in Space. So,
do you talk yourself at the conference?
Yes, I do. I always speak first because my view is no one really likes going on first, and it's my fault that we're all here. So last year I talked about self-service checkout machines and why we should not still be struggling. And if you are struggling, people always kind of complain about unexpected items in bagging areas, but you've had sort of 10 years to learn how to use this quite straightforward technology. Possibly the problem lies with you.
Good point.
I was trying to sort of record unexpected, like sort of a sound clip of it, and I couldn't work out how people were setting this off, because I was like, what are you doing to the machine to make that sound? I had to...
You and I will go to the supermarket after this.
Yeah, I mean, some people do still struggle.
That was James Ward, founder and director of the Boring Conference. Next, it's time for an explosion of sequins, lycra and iconic Swedish pop. ABBA won Eurovision 40 years ago, and the music world was altered forever. In March of this year, London's Swedish embassy held an event to celebrate ABBA in all its glory. I went along and spoke to some of Sweden's music industry VIPs, including ABBA's own Frida.
No more race to play, the winner takes it all.
I'm Matt Swedbom, I'm a culture councillor at the Embassy of Sweden in Paris, and also director of the Swedish Institute in Paris.
What's your favorite ABBA song and why?
The Winner Takes It All, very much due to, I think, Meryl Streep's performance in the film Mamma Mia. She did such a wonderful version of The Winner Takes It All. Yes, sometimes we talk about the Swedish music wonder. There was a seminar yesterday about that, and the relation between technological and innovation, and many Swedes that have music in their blood since they were kids. And I think in Sweden, most people in the world per capita is singing in choirs. So that could be another reason that we are a very musical people.
My name is Jarl Hanser, and my favorite ABBA song is The Winner Takes It All, like so many others.
You were ABBA's manager for how long?
I started to work with Stig Anderson long before ABBA, and then I've followed them through their career, and I'm still working with them.
I'm the publisher of Max Strom Publishing in Sweden. My name is Jeppe Wikström.
And you're the man behind the huge event at Tate Modern, which was launching the big book.
Yes, I'm afraid I'm one of them at least. So,
tell me about the book.
It's quite a massive thing. We sifted through more than 250,000 images to select the 600 ones that are actually finally in the book. But it's in this format of a regular old-fashioned LP, but it's very thick, 3 kilos heavy.
How many of those photographs were unseen before?
Well, it's well over 100 that they've never seen before. And oddly enough, even more had never been seen by the Abbas, because they were on the other side of the camera and they may not have had the chance to read the newspapers and magazines in those days.
What was their reaction to the book?
Well, we got really good reactions. I mean, we said we really have 4 important reviewers, and they're not working for The Times, The Guardian, or The Observer. Those are 4 very special people, and they were all very, very happy and really enthusiastic. And so those were our most important reviewers. Fortunately, the reviewers and as well as readers and book buyers seem to love the book as well.
What's your favourite Abbas story?
Well, actually, my favourite Abbas story, I think, is from Australia. I think it may have been in Adelaide, where there was a bomb threat at a concert, so they had to abandon the arena, and everybody had to go outside. And then Benny and Bjorn and the others went outside and sat there, played accordion and singing with people to keep them happy until they could go inside again. That little notion tells a lot about Abba, how they are. Very generous people, down to earth, really loving their fans.
Well, I'm the Swedish ambassador in London. My favorite song is Super Trooper, and actually it should have been filmed in Piccadilly Circus, the video, but there was no permission given, so it was then shot in Sweden.
In the 70s, ABBA suddenly were this huge explosion in Australia, which they hadn't particularly been back at home in Sweden. Was that because of the social democracy movement going on at home?
I think that they were quite popular in Sweden. But of course, the thing about Australia was that I think they weren't really prepared for the kind of success that they saw there. And when we read about the trip there and the fact that people lined up all the way from the airport into town, that is quite amazing. So maybe in Australia it was just almost over the top when it came to sort of how many fans they had. But Swedes in general, I remember as a small child, I mean, of course we had all the records and we didn't hide them. We played them all the time.
Now they've become, and as has music generally from Sweden, become a major part of your arsenal in your soft power weaponry. Tell me about that.
Well, I would argue that the victory of ABBA 40 years ago very much put Swedish music on the map, and that what you see today with all the different artists that we have, that they have, many of them have been inspired by the success of ABBA. So many great groups today, and we've seen over the years Europe, Roxette, now Swedish House Mafia, Avicii, etc. So many excellent pop groups.
Another of the books being launched was ABBA, The Backstage Stories, written by Ing-Marie Halling. Can you tell me about your history with ABBA? How did you first start working with the group?
This started out back in 76. I was together with a guy called Lasse. He was playing guitar for ABBA. And I tagged along for a couple of concerts. So I met them. And then I met Frida and we sort of clicked. At that time, I was working with makeup and hair for a theater company in Sweden, in Stockholm. So when they were going on tour to Australia, this was planned, 76, they started planning this. She called me and said, would you like to join us to do makeup and hair?
You went on tour with them on 3 separate tours.
Yeah.
So the book that you have now written is all about how ABBA presented themselves to the world, really, with your help.
Actually, it's about the everyday life of ABBA, because I love to be true to the story. And also a big factor is I wanted to give a tribute to all these people that are working backstage with bands and theaters and whatever not.
because it's called Backstage Stories in one iteration, but actually it's a book with several names in several different languages.
Well, this is a very international book. Could depend on the fact that this group is very international. But the English publisher wanted one name on the book, The Treasures, while I had the book from the beginning as The Backstage Stories, because it is my backstage stories. But, you know, whatever blows your hair back.
Well, speaking about hair, that's one of the stories that's in the book.
Oh, yeah. You know, I had been working with this ballet company, and they do a lot of spins and jumps and things. So I really learned the art of wig making and how to put on a wig properly, which is done in a very special way. So I was quite secure about that. And that this was the second concert in Sydney, 77. And I don't know where my brain was, but I sort of did not do a proper job. So standing in the wing, I see Frida do a dance routine that she does. She did a big spin, and this wig just came off, and it flew like a bird over the stage. And I remember seeing that, and in a second I thought, this is it. They will send me home. But Frida, she is that kind of person. She walks up to the wig, puts it on like a big hat, starts laughing, and then she keeps on dancing. That's how she works.
Now, of course, Waterloo was the song that really, really launched them in the international scene. But that song didn't even start off being called Waterloo. It was Honey Pie. Tell me about the evolution of the song from Honey Pie to worldwide fame.
From the beginning, Björn wrote lyrics with words that gave a tempo, that worked with the tempo in the song. He didn't mind about the actual lyrics as long as it worked with the song. So he was the kind of guy who was, as soon as he had a piece of paper, he wrote a lyric on it. And finally he ended up with a proper one that was to be. But from the beginning on a song, it could be about mashed potatoes. Because the word mashed potatoes worked with the song. So any song coming from ABBA had a long way to go from beginning to recording.
I have to ask you the one last question, and I so hope I know how you're going to answer it. Will they get back together? Is there one last reunion tour?
If I'm supposed to answer that from my perspective, I would say definitely no, it won't happen. My biggest wish ever is that these four guys would do three concerts in Hyde Park and three concerts in Central Park, and invite, you know, old friends like Pierce Brosnan or Meryl Streep or things like that. Do a nice proper show for adults, and the tickets would cost zillions of money, and every penny should go to building music schools in the third world.
How likely?
Well, you know, I'm a firm believer in, you know, you start nagging and nagging and suddenly it works. Yes, I let the music speak. I let the music speak.
ABBA won Eurovision in 1974. In 1997, Katrina and the Waves, previously known for the hit Walking on Sunshine, won by the biggest amount of votes before or since in the competition.
Yes, I was invited out to do a show in Beijing, China, 3 months ago. They were having their Happy New Year television recording extravaganza. And it was with the original ABBA backing band. So it was the original drummer and the original bass player. The rest were kind of made up. But boy, that was a real thrill. And they were performing to Walking on Sunshine. And they can still, they absolutely rock out.
Back in the 70s when ABBA were first around, they were perhaps slightly derided by the rest of the musical community. Do you think that that was the case, and is it still? Are they still, or perhaps they have musical respect now?
I think it's sort of like the Carpenters, where you wouldn't really admit that you had their albums because your parents did, but now our children have their albums, and I think that speaks volumes.
What's your favorite ABBA song, and why?
It's got to be the name of the game, because it's got the most wonderful lyrics and the most wonderful tune, and it's a little bit heartbreaking. And the way they sing with those accents on that track in particular is extremely endearing. What's the name of the game?
My name is Ulrika Finnerö. I'm working at the Swedish Embassy. And my favorite ABBA song is Dancing Queen, because I played it with my friends at the daycare when I was a little girl.
If you could just say your name and what you do.
Mikael Persson. I'm the Swedish rector of them. So my parish is the British Isles. I take care of Swedes, helping them out with how it is to be Swedish and become a bit more British in this country.
What's your favorite ABBA song?
Oh, I can name many, but I think Dancing Queen is my favorite. Do you want to know why? I married the niece of the king quite a couple of years ago, and on my right was the queen at the dinner. And it was the 19th of June, and being brought up in a Swedish way, you dance with the lady you have on your right. You have to do that. And I understood afterwards the queen never dances, but I danced to the queen, to that music, which they had was written to their wedding. So Dancing Queen is my favorite, and she's my favorite queen, Sylvia, I must say.
Finally, there was a surprise guest at the event, and so the last word must go to Annefrid Lindstad. I asked her what ABBA's favorite ABBA song is.
That is not for me to answer, actually. I think we have very personal opinion, but I'm sure that all four of us love the Dancing Queen. I think I would vote for that one. Friday night and the lights are low. Looking out for a place to go. Where they play the right music. Getting in the swing. You come to look for a
king. Dancing Queen from ABBA, finishing that celebration of Sweden's biggest pop export, ABBA. Still to come on this episode of the Saturday Selection, we discuss a book about a book and discover why whiskey deserves a renaissance.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monaco shop.
Welcome back to the Saturday Selection, the best of the weekend edition on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. Next we meet British author Rebecca Mead, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's written a personal meditation on George Eliot's classic book Middlemarch, called My Life in Middlemarch. It's an involving story of how a passionate attachment to a great work of literature can shape our lives and help us to read our own histories.
When you have a book, and many people have a book that they return to, and it doesn't have to be Middlemarch. And I think that, you know, what I'm saying in my book will be recognized by people who haven't even read Middlemarch, maybe, but they have their own relationship with their own cherished book or books or author. And that idea that, you know, when you read something and you reread it, it becomes woven into the fabric of your life. I mean, I don't read Middlemarch as like a distraction from my life. It is actually part of my life. I've read it so many times and it has mattered so much to me that I really don't know who I would be without it.
Virginia Woolf said it was one of the few English novels written for grown-up people. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing to say. Mm. I mean, I think what she's getting at is this idea that, you know, it doesn't have a happy ending. It's not tied up neatly. And although there are characters who are happy at the end, their happiness is in many ways contingent upon a kind of acceptance of the limitations of an ordinary life. You know, the people in the novel who strive to do great things, and there are several of them, do not do the great things that they strove to do, and nonetheless, to a greater or lesser degree, find happiness, find satisfaction. I mean, Dorothea Brooke doesn't become Saint Teresa as she once aspired to be, and a lot of people have been upset by that fact that she doesn't become a great woman, but she becomes a, we think, a kind of contented woman, and that there's something very consoling, I think, in reading a novel that doesn't have to end with everybody sort of concluding in a blaze of glory, that there's this kind of quiet, modest sense of acceptance. And, you know, George Eliot says in the end of the novel that every limit is a beginning as well as an ending. And so the idea that there's within limitation, there is more that can be done and more that can be expressed, and that, you know, limitation isn't always a terrible thing.
Can a novel be a handbook for living, a guide for life?
Well, I suppose it can. I mean, I wouldn't say that Middlemarch has been a handbook by any means to me. I mean, I think it would be very reductive to think of it as a guide to life, or, you know, as a self-help book or something like that. That's not how I experience it. And in fact, if I were following the advice, as it were, that Middlemarch were giving, there are lots of choices I've made that I wouldn't have made. You know, it's more that it gives me, and I think, you know, other books can do this too, a way of understanding in retrospect the choices that I have made, and understanding the relationships that I've formed, and understanding people in my own life better. I do think that what reading a great book does, and Middlemarch is very, very well positioned to do this, because it's one of the things that George Eliot was trying to do, it does give you an experience of empathy with the characters in the book. You know, Middlemarch moves your sympathies from Dorothea Brooke to her husband, Edward Casaubon, who, you know, seems at first sight to be just awful and terrible. And then you learn to feel sorry for him too. And George Eliot's very concerned about giving the reader that experience. And so I think that by reading it and by rereading it, and hopefully just by growing older and growing up, one can learn to be more sympathetic oneself. So in some sense, I think that reading it is good for you, but that you don't read it because it's good for you.
Mm. You have approached the book really as a biographer, as a memoirist, and as a critic, that there are three definite strands in there, really. Mm-hmm. Explore those a bit for me.
Well, there have been many biographies of George Eliot written, and I wasn't going to write a straight biography, but I did want to sort of explore particularly the arc of her life during the time that she was writing Middlemarch, and who was she interacting with, and who was coming onto her radar, and what was going on. And, you know, among other things, she nursed the son of her partner, George Henry Lewes, died. I mean, he was 25 years old, and he died while she was in the middle of writing Middlemarch. I think this is very relevant to the way in which she creates the characters of the different young men in the novel of Middlemarch. And then my own personal story, you know, I also married a man who had three sons, as George Eliot, you know, she didn't marry George Henry Lewes, but as good as, you know, he had three sons. And so I feel that being a stepmother gives me, not that it makes me understand George Eliot, or I know what she was thinking or anything like that. I wouldn't be so bold as to say that. But I think what I wanted to bring to bear was my own experience and my own insight that might offer, the light that might shed on understanding who she was and what it was like for her to be in this unusual family situation herself. So there was a way in which I wanted to weave together those three strands, and for the light that, you know, each of those things could shed on the other.
Mm. And I mean, very movingly, the way, for instance, you bring together the death of your own father and the death that happens in the book, it's all very, it's very movingly written.
Thank you. I mean, it was very movingly wrote too. I mean, you know, as I was writing it, this book was a joy to write and a very intense experience to write. I've never had a writing experience like it. And my father died while I was writing the book. And so, you know, the first half of the book is written in the anticipation of his death. I knew he was ill and ailing. And the second half of it is written with that having happened. So in a way, the whole experience was very, very charged and fed into the narrative that I was telling in kind of peculiar and unexpected ways. But there were parts where I cried when I was writing the book. There were parts where I laughed when I was writing the book. I was very, very engaged with writing this. This was not just a piece of journalism.
That was Rebecca Mead, author of My Life in Middlemarch. You're listening to the Saturday Selection, the best of the weekend edition on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin. Maureen Freely is an award-winning author, journalist, translator and academic. In March, it was announced that Freely would become president of English Pen, a global literary human rights organisation. US-born Freely grew up in Turkey and now lives in England. I invited her onto the show to talk about English Pen and her work promoting freedom of expression.
It's under threat here because really the rules have changed with the arrival of information technology. For a long time, we in this country could just count ourselves lucky that we were in a place where if we were pretty reasonable, we could get by without getting into any trouble. But now, of course, anytime we send a tweet, if you're the person kind of person who has time for that sort of thing, we are actually subject to some pretty draconian laws. And of course, there's another issue, which is surveillance and privacy on the internet and so on. So I think it's a time when writers have increasingly realized that as much as we like to just sit at home and look at the walls of our heads, that actually we have to get out there and be part of this conversation about what is right and fair. And also, we're not just doing it for ourselves this time. We're doing it for everybody because everybody's a writer now because we're all writing online all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's been an implosion of the literary end of publishing. I know that's something that you've written about. Tell us why that's happening and what can be done.
I think it's been going on for a long time, and it was even happening 1,000 years ago when I started publishing. That's, to be specific, I think it was 1979. Already, the houses that had sort of made London and New York the special places that they were after the war were beginning to, and a lot of those had a sort of very central European understanding of literature and its importance. And they started getting swallowed up by some larger companies, which then got swallowed up by some larger companies. Eventually, they become part of a really, well, the financialized world. And increasingly, the profits and the profit margins are subject to the same sort of expectations as a financial product would be, or shoes. Mm. So I don't think that that's actually a viable model for publishing in the long run. I'm full of admiration for the people who are still in there, bringing out some pretty wonderful books. But the days when novelists like me, or novelists who sell a little bit more than me, could depend on making a living freelance, a book contract here, a few reviews and interviews and columns there, those days are over.
And not everyone can be E.L. James. Thank heavens, some might say. Let's talk about literature in translation, because, of course, you're very well known for doing a lot of translation for Orhan Pamuk, the Nobel laureate, Turkish Nobel laureate. But there is a bias against literature in translation. Why is that, do you think?
Although we've been really quite successful in the past 10 years, our networks in English Pen and the Society of Authors and the Translators Association and the Foreign Fiction Prize and so on. So we've actually sort of increased interest in really interesting books from outside the world. But still, there's a preference for certain types of things. So I don't even need to mention Eurocrime or Scandinavian crime.
Scandinavian, yeah.
And there's a bit of a kind of a prejudice in favor of a book that will be like taking a little holiday to Sri Lanka instead of actually going there. So we do have these trends that we have to still deal with. It's still the best thing I do every year is just to read the shortlist of the Foreign Fiction Prize, because there are always going to be authors from countries I've never become acquainted with before.
Mm-hmm. So this is something that Penn is actively working towards improving.
Yes. As of 3 years ago, especially, it made translation and world literature put that at the center of its understanding of itself. And this is over and above all the work that we do for authors who are in trouble in other countries.
You've written 3 novels chronicling life amongst the American community in Istanbul in the 1960s and the 1970s, Cold War Turkey. And your latest is Sailing Through Byzantium. First of all, this to me feels very autobiographical. How close is it to your own life?
Just about everything that happens in this book happened to me in one way or another, but it's differently arranged And it's arranged differently, not to depart from the truth in this odd way, but to get closer to what mattered, what hurts still, and also get closer to that impossible beauty of that crazy time. So when my agent took me out to lunch, he said, well, it just reads like a memoir to me. And he said, why don't we do it as a memoir? And I said, well, we can't. He said, why? I said, because I made it up. And then we went through character by character. And I said, I made it up, but actually, in a certain way, I didn't. So, yeah. Sorry to sound so Sufi.
We see the return of some characters, though, from your previous two books.
Yes. I think one of the reasons that happens is because I got to like these characters so much, I didn't want to let them go. But also, I'm thinking about something in a longer term. The community I grew up in was around what was an American college and university, and then later became nationalized. And it was opened in 1863, so it's 150 years ago. And most of the Americans who went to work there, for one reason or another, they were, you know, trying to get away for a while, and very, very much so in the Cold War time. They were trying to get away from McCarthy. In my family's case, that was very much so. So they were, you know, not the greatest patriots and looking for something better, more beautiful, and so on. But, you know, after they finished their time, they would just go back. And so nobody who was there, or almost nobody who was there, had an idea of the longer history we're all part of. It was very fragmented. And one of the things I've wanted to do by using some of the same characters, never the same characters, quite in the center, two books in a row, is to try to look at how all that holds together, and particularly to look at this kind of untold story about what you might say the phantom empire. The United States understands that it's an empire only at wartime, and it doesn't really look at what's going on the rest of the time. It can be bad and ugly. It can also be beautiful and good, but it's usually a horribly difficult combination of all those things. So it's more than enough to write about.
That was Maureen Freely, author, translator and president of English Pen. After this short break, we'll be talking about whiskey and why one man thinks it deserves a fresh perspective.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
With the Saturday Selection, a collection of the best interviews of the previous month on Monocle 24's Weekend Edition, with me, Georgina Godwin. Before we end the show, we've got time for one more chat, and it wouldn't seem right to finish the programme without offering a dram of whisky. Originally from Glasgow, Dave Broom is a whisky man. He's been writing about it, researching it, and drinking it as long as he can remember. Earlier in the year, Broom released his ode to all things malty, Whisky, a Manual. The book tells of whiskey's many personalities worldwide and how people can afford to relax now and enjoy the spirit in more ways than just neat.
Where there is civilization, there is distillation. You know, the two things go hand in hand. You know, it is a human imperative. We have to get drunk. The interesting thing about looking at the history of distillation is that distillers use what grow around them. You know, so if you're in France and you've got grapes, you're going to make cognac. If you're in the Caribbean, you've got cane, you're going to make rum. If you're in Mexico, you've got agave, you're going to make tequila. And if you're in the grain belt of Northern Europe or in America, you're going to distill that and you're going to make whiskey. And in Scotland, barley grows because of the climate, so we use barley. In America, where corn grows more than barley, they use corn, you know, as the base. So it comes out of that. When did it start? The first record of
beer being distilled. Basically, whiskey is basically just distilled beer. The first record of beer being distilled in the English language actually comes from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. So the first record is actually from England rather than Scotland. And it was part of a great list of alchemical ingredients. So it's been, and that well, that's Canterbury Tales, which is end of 1396, I think. In Scotland, the first record of beer being distilled, 1494, but by 1526, already it's being flavoured up. Probably the knowledge was slightly older than that. But initially, a lot of these grain-based spirits, or you know, distilled beer spirits, would then have been redistilled with herbs and spices and flavoured up and coloured with saffron or spinach root or whatever to make them very, very interesting drinks.
Mm, and of course, how it's stored, the type of wood that the cask is made out of, all of that is very important.
It's vitally important. I mean, maturation whiskey really only begins to take place in a serious form, really from the late 18th century onwards. Prior to that, it was drunk pretty much neat. You know, if you had it sitting in a barrel, it was sitting in a barrel. But yeah, I mean, the type of wood, really, really important. I mean, 70% of a whiskey's flavour is coming from the way in which the cask interacts with the spirit. So yeah, the wood and the quality of the wood is vitally, vitally important. The interesting thing about whiskey is that as soon as you get an economy which begins to grow and you've got a young middle class, whiskey becomes one of the things that you just have to have. Again, it's a kind of signifier of success. So you've got a nice suit, you've got a nice car, you know, you've got a nice watch, and the drink that you choose tends to be whiskey. It tends to be, was Scotch whiskey, but I think Irish and bourbon, etc., are coming in. And also, I mean, in simple terms, you know, whiskey has been sold and been popular in Latin America for many years, but again, went through a bit of a kind of downturn in the 1980s, 1990s onwards. But as soon as economies began to pick up, suddenly you got a new generation. You're kind of going, this is a great drink, and, you know, this says a lot about me. You know, all the signs around whiskey kind of say, I am successful, I've made it. And it's the way it is drunk in Latin America is very different. Again, it is something which kind of comes back to the book, because, you know, one of the myths which we have about whiskey in these mature markets is that it's a solitary drink. You know, you're sitting down there at night after dinner on your own with your whiskey, you know, and you're kind of cradling it, and yet it's not for sharing, which is its complete opposite to what it's meant to be. It's complete opposite to the way it's drunk in Latin America, where you go out, there's a bottle bought, it's put in the middle of the table, maybe in an ice bucket, there's a big bucket of ice, there's mixers, and everybody just sits around and shares it. They don't necessarily get drunk, you know, everybody just enjoys it. And that's what's important about it. And I think from looking at it from that perspective, you kind of say, well, we're the ones who are out of step with the way that whiskey is actually meant to be drunk around the world, because, you know, the great stick in the muds are actually Northern Europe and America. Mm-hmm. Japan has kind of gone a great highball boom as well. So we're the ones who are kind of saying, no, you don't do it that way. But actually, you do it that way because it's fun. And it really works with the flavours.
Tell me about Canadian whiskey, because that's a slightly different kind. It's more blended.
Canadian whiskey is blended, yeah. Kind of lots of different styles of whiskey being made at quite large distilleries. So it's kind of single distillery blends, if you want, to different types. The sleeping giant of whiskey, basically Canada. I love Canadian whiskey. It's very Canadian. You know, the Canadians are just the nicest people in the world. You know, you cannot get annoyed with a Canadian, even though you want to, you know, because they're just so nice. And their whiskies are just so nice. And they've been too modest about the quality of their whiskies. One of the interesting things when doing the research for the book is that it wasn't until 2010 that American whiskey outsold Canadian whiskey in America. So Canadian whiskey is big. Canadian whiskey is popular. Canadian whiskey is great, great quality. It tends to be slightly lighter. It tends to be sweeter, but it's got this wonderful little rye twang to it. So it's got that nice acidity and it works brilliantly. It's a very, very amenable whiskey. So it goes great with all mixers. So if you want to have it with especially ginger ale, it's absolutely brilliant.
I want to talk a little bit about branding, and there's slightly nauseating adverts about men who've, you know, rolled the barrel from their grandfather's house down the hill and how it all tastes of Uncle Bob's sweat or whatever it is. You know what I'm talking about. Now, that seems something that's quite prevalent in the whiskey industry.
Yeah, it's, you know, and you can see why to a certain extent, because, you know, especially single malt, I mean, it's all about provenance and it's all about age and it's all about time. I mean, there's a difference to age and maturity, but, you know, it's about this idea of something which is to a certain extent, timeless. I mean, the first record for real whiskey drinking goes back to 1526. So you can understand, you know, the heritage. And it is part of, you know, speaking as a proud Scotsman, you know, it is part of our heritage. It is the same with Ireland, and it's part of their heritage. So yes, it's important, but I do agree with you that it can be quite easily overdone. And there are various ways of actually talking about whiskey to make it more relevant to today's drinker and more relevant to today's Scotland or today's Canada or today's America.
Or indeed today's Sweden. Now that's a new market.
Sweden, I mean, the Nordic countries are, you know, have been great whiskey drinkers for a long time, but the market over there has just exploded. And also what's exploded over there is distilling. So there are now about 20 distilleries in Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Norway, and also one and another one about to appear in Iceland as well. So they're making their own whiskey. And interestingly, you know, going back to what we were saying about Japan, they're making it in a very unique way. So that they're taking cognizance of what grows around them, of their heritage, of their flavours, and actually making whiskey that speaks about where it is coming from. Which kind of comes back to that point. You know, whiskey is rooted in place and it's rooted in culture in the same way as wine is. And maybe that is a slightly better way of looking at it rather than this, I agree, slightly cliched way of, you know, just having huge hairy people in kilts, wandering down the road with stags at bay and rabbits at bay and, you know, all of that. So there are various ways to do it, but as long as I think that understanding that whiskey is made by people, it's not made by machines, and it comes from culture and it comes from a specific place, I think there's a huge opportunity to talk in a new way about whiskey.
That was Dave Broom, author of Whiskey, a Manual. Well, that's all we've got time for on this month's episode of the Saturday Selection, where we give you the best of the month's offerings from Monocle 24's Saturday Weekend Edition. This episode was produced by Claire Urban, and I'm Georgina Godwin. Join us again next month to hear some of the very best of the weekend's interviews on Monocle 24. And of course, you can always listen live every Saturday. If you'd like to drop us a line, please email gg@monocle.com. Thanks for listening.